Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. When will the wars be over and lives return to, quote, normal? Those times seem increasingly elusive as the lines between wartime and peacetime are blurred. The so-called time of war affects every aspect of life. It changes laws, civil liberties, and the public's relationship to the law, bending the laws in favor of security for the state, and ultimately affecting democracy itself. War also demarcates history eras. But what about when war seems to go on endlessly? What exactly is wartime, and how does that blurring of lines affect laws and society? Three experts join us now. Mary Dujack is professor of law, history, and political science at USC and author of several books, including Wartime, An Idea, Its History, Its Consequences. Patrick James also joins us. He's director of the Center for International Studies, a professor of international relations at USC and author of numerous books, including Religion, Identity, and Global Governance, Crisis in War, A New Quest for International Peace, and Wars in the Midst of Peace. Chris McKnight-Nichols joins us. He's professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Promise and Peril, America at the Dawn of a Global Age. Mary Dujack, let's begin with you. Your concept of wartime as a construct that has been kind of imagined, as you say, somewhat differently than its reality. How have we come to see wartime, and how does that articulation affect the fundamental legal and cultural aspects of life?
Wartime does a lot of work in American politics and culture. We see the concept of wartime often being used as an argument for why we should adopt policies like enhanced interrogation, for example, waterboarding. Why do we do things like this? Because it's wartime. When someone uses wartime as an argument, they're basically arguing that the nation's existence is at stake, but also that wartime means that what we're doing is going to go away, because built into the concept of wartime is the idea that war is, by definition, temporary. And the reason I say that is we imagine history proceeding from one kind of time to the next, from wartime to peacetime to wartime to peacetime. We imagine that there's a future called peacetime where war will not exist. So wartime brings with it the idea of war's temporariness. And the way that it figures in, we'll see, for example, the Supreme Court grappling with the question of how do we deal with the legality of detentions at Guantanamo. Well, under the law, enemy combatants can be detained for the duration of the conflict. And so these folks are being detained for the duration of the conflict. And yet the conflict, the way it's been articulated, doesn't have an end point. If it's a war on terror, the way Bush put it, if it's a war on Al-Qaeda, the way Obama has framed it, then these are wars against concepts or tactics or amorphous groups that aren't going to cease to exist anywhere in the world for a very, very, very long time, if ever. So we essentially have this idea that war is temporary, that wartime policies are therefore temporary, but that coexists with a context of ongoing warfare that doesn't fit the concept.
There are two directions I want to go in. One is going to be to bring in Pat James to look at this from the international relations perspective, and then with Chris McKnight-Nichols to look at this historically in the United States of America. Pat James, within the context of international relations, wars, ethnic conflicts, what Manus Midlarsky calls systemic wars. What is the international political context for war, wartime, and peace?
I think Mary is right in her book with its emphasis on the evolution of a concept. This whole idea of wartime, it almost ends up being a major pun, in that we close our eyes and we envision old movies where there's a home front and there's a fixed period of time where the boys go marching off and then they come home, and there's sort of an end point then, if you will. Somebody then wins the war, the winners write the peace, and so on and so forth, and they put the bad guys on trial. What she points out, I think, so well in her book is that whether you look at it as a cumulative, gradual process or something that's more binary because of 9/11, this whole notion that, quote-unquote, war is this discrete thing in time that you could make movies about, you could write books about, and that somehow it begins and ends. And then from a sort of international relations / international law standpoint, there's wartime law and there's peacetime law. All of that, by the time you get through her very masterful and easy-to-read work, all of that is gone. It's incinerated, and the situation is much more complex. I would say, for me, the most interesting thing from an international relations standpoint concerns the relationship of prosecuting a war to the legal foundations of going to war. And by that I mean the United States, for example, has not actually declared war on anybody since December 8, 1941, namely against Japan after Pearl Harbor. Since then, the U.S. has been involved in any number of military deployments, but there's nothing that looks exactly like a stereotypical war. And where we are is that the conflicts we have, like Afghanistan or whatever, they're not even really about a place anymore. They're sometimes, as Mary points out, about concepts, about tactics, whatever we might call them. One key thing for international relations scholars to think about then is, because of this mushiness, this lack of boundaries, that the law and legal precepts are much more in play 24/7, 365 than they once were. My own particular comment on this, I made a number on a very interesting panel on Mary's book a while ago at the law school, is that we have to think very seriously about what we are willing to do and how far we're willing to go if we deploy force. I'll stop there for the moment, but I'm a big fan of thinking that parallels what's been known as the Powell Doctrine, as in, if you're going to do it, then go all out and get it done and be extremely, extremely restricted in your usages of force.
Chris McKnight-Nichols, let's bring you in and take a look at this from the historic context in the U.S.
Mary makes some superb points in the book regarding the longer history of wartime, particularly in the 20th century. And here she really illuminates sort of the central paradoxes and the social constructedness of time, wartime and peacetime, as a kind of facile binary. And she begins with a great incident, unfortunate incident, the last peacetime casualty or wartime casualty in this case in East Germany of a fellow by the name of Arthur Nicholson. And the question is sort of severalfold, whether or not he deserves burial in Arlington National Cemetery, which he does receive, then what should be written on his gravestone, killed in East Germany, U.S. military liaison, doesn't state formally what conflict he was engaged in. And so this gets at to the question of what exactly was the Cold War, as a series of hot wars, of proxy conflicts. And then she opens that up to sort of think through what most Americans would perceive as perhaps the most discrete of conflicts, the Second World War, beginning for many Americans with Pearl Harbor, of course, and concluding with the peace signing on the battleship Missouri, or perhaps simply with the dropping of atomic bombs. And here, Mary's work also shows us what those of us in historical circles know well, the long lead time into these conflicts is just as important. One insight that I would draw from the book more broadly is that Americans are very often de facto committed to conflicts, whether they be small or large, World War I, World War II, Cold War examples. So too are small conflicts, such as American engagement in the Philippines, which lasted from 1898 through 1946, when the Philippines gets its formal independence. But the U.S. sort of has a vacillating relationship with these conflicts in terms of the sort of constructs of wartime and peacetime, and yet the commitments are just as strong. Troops are dying on the ground, just like Arthur Nicholson, who was laid to rest in 1985, and yet the sort of existential question about what is this war remains. And it strikes me that historically, pushing back even farther, we have several other questions related to this at the intersection of the law, history, and conflicts. Abraham Lincoln's famous suspension of habeas corpus and the related rulings on that in the Civil War era through the end of the 19th century, the Spanish-American War, and Mary's comments just now to start off our conversation reminded me of William James's remarks about something related. That is, he argued that a concept such as manifest destiny, which seemed to motivate so many Americans in conflicts, the sort of belligerency and passion of Americans in wartime, are really empty concepts. He argued that they were, quote, specious abstractions. But the problem, of course, is that there's a great traction of these kinds of concepts, like wartime or like manifest destiny, that make it particularly problematic in terms of democratic accountability in times of war.
I'm going to want to get back to the democratic accountability question. In fact, I was hoping to end with that. But before then, as we're looking at this kind of relationship between war, society, law, democratic participation that is really all linked into when a war begins and when it ends. Mary, you have looked at several wars. World War II was one. The Cold War was another. The War on Terrorism was another. And they're very different kinds of wars. You tried to define them. What did you conclude?
What I do in the book is I start by taking apart the concept of wartime, and then I look at a series of examples to illustrate the pliability of the concept, the way that it doesn't fit into time boundaries the way we imagine it. So I look at World War II really not to define it better, but instead to illustrate that the way we think about World War II doesn't fit. And that's that it's now remembered as the good war, the quintessential kind of war, in part because it was a declared war, so it's thought of as having a definite starting point. And then it all ended with VJ Day, the Japanese surrender in 1945. But instead what happens is even that iconic war is fuzzy at the edges. The U.S. involvement ramps up over time, as Chris suggested, and U.S. involvement and deployments sort of continue on afterwards. The Cold War, then, is an interesting problem because, you know, how does the Cold War fit? Even the name, the Cold War, is incoherent because wars aren't cold. So it should cause us to think about what was this and does it actually serve as a useful comparison with other things we think of as a wartime? And what you see is there's just not a fit between this long period of diplomatic tension where the wars that are going on are usually proxy wars, smaller wars, different places in the world where there's a central adversary is the Soviet Union. So the Cold War itself doesn't fit within the usual definition of war, the way we tend to think about it. But what happens often in the scholarship, including the legal scholarship that uses different wars as examples to think about American war policy and the law over time, the Cold War is basically shoved back into the pre-existing, simpler conceptual framework that we have wartime and peacetime and we move from one to the other. Then the post-9/11 era is on some level a repeat of the Cold War history, where you have another period that simply doesn't fit the model, as we see so clearly now as first President Bush, then President Obama, trying to, at least as a matter of American politics, say that conflicts are ending, but they just won't end. And then we're sending military forces other places like drones over Pakistan and Yemen, etc. So what we have is this much messier era of ongoing conflict. But what scholars do is, at least in the law world, they start calling wartime something different because post-9/11 doesn't seem to fit. So then they call it a crisis time. They rename other war times as crisis, like World War II now is a crisis time, so that they can compare different crisis times against each other. But still have this general assumption that there's something called normal time that we experience that's periodically ruptured and then restored. And so that basic temporal set of ideas, which builds in the idea that war is by definition temporary, you enter it and those powers and those rights of compromises are by definition going to come to an end. That conceptualization lingers.
Pat James, let's bring you back in, because this muddling must really affect the international relations scholarship. How does the international relations field deal with counting them, knowing when they are resolving and not resolving, when you have this kind of gray area?
Yes. What has happened, if you follow the scholarship in the area, is there is an awareness of this change in that once upon a time, let's go back close to 50 years ago during the early days of high-speed computing and the ability to construct, you know, large-scale data sets, initially very discrete, very standard-looking events like World War II and others got packaged together into interstate war data sets. What we've seen since then is an awareness of two things. One is that the boundaries of such discrete events are breaking down. So instead of collecting data strictly about traditional interstate wars between two countries, scholars, in fact, over the last few decades have evolved toward not only collecting that, because sometimes we have things that look like a traditional old-fashioned war, like the first phase of Iraq in 2003. But then many of these conflicts, of course, don't end like an old-fashioned war. They morph into something else. A reasonable person could say that there's still some kind of conflict going on in Iraq right now, or for that matter, Afghanistan, even though at one point each of them was an old-school type of war. So the first thing that's changing is new kinds of data sets are being collected that reflect the fact that a lot of conflicts are going on in ways that are non-traditional, so they get new names or labels. You mentioned Midlarsky and his systemic concept. There are other things we could talk about. Data, believe it or not, was not collected on the subject of civil wars until quite recently. So you look at what Afghanistan or Iraq would be, and you'd have to say they didn't end up in the traditional old-style way where they had a clear point of termination. And the other thing that's going on, and it's connected, is that most of the casualties around the world from warfare are being experienced in unconventional types of events that are more civil than international and that do not have clear beginnings or endings. Some of them arguably are discrete. They're taking place inside the borders of one country, but some are not, like what went on in the mid-1990s in Africa. Some have called that Africa's Third World War, right, with the Congo and Rwanda and so on and so forth. So there is an awareness on the part of the scholarship that the events aren't as easily packaged as they used to be, that they're not strictly interstate, and most of the lethality out there, most of the casualties, that's really coming from things that don't look like old school wars.
So it's really almost like there's this continuum of conflict that ebbs and flows rather than something with a beginning, a middle, and an end.
That's right. And to the extent that you can even find a beginning, middle, and end, it won't even look like it once did, where there's a clear declaration of victory by one side or the other, defeat for the other adversary. And then look what happened with Iraq, a perfect example here, Afghanistan. It just doesn't look anything like the World War II model, where you had the trials in Japan and Germany of war criminals. Here it's so ambiguous and so muddy. When Mary mentioned something like, for example, the controversy that has gone on over the detainees at Gitmo, well, that, the last time I looked, was the winning side, right? I mean, it's the winning side that was being criticized for its actions in relation to the quote-unquote losing side or adversary. That's just unthinkable, if you will, until very recently. So that also, in a sense, challenges beginning, middle, end, good guy, bad guy, victory, defeat. It's just a whole lot more gray than black and white.
Chris McKnight-Nichols, let's bring you back in. How do you fit these, say, the war on terror, within a look at American history with its engagement in war or restraining an engagement with that middle ground? And look at it also from this perspective that you have explored with regards to isolationism and the middle ground there.
I think Mary's book really usefully illuminates the best comparison of the war on terror to a historical precedent, and that is the Cold War, a war that's conceived of as having a discrete enemy and a confrontation between two powers, and yet ultimately it isn't taking the shape in the present in terms of the war on terror, or in the past in terms of the Cold War. It did not take the shape of a kind of conventional war in the way that, say, Clausewitz or others might have articulated such a conflict. In the longer history and historiography, to compare the international relations to history as well, I think the divide is really that scholars, I agree completely, scholars have found this gray area in terms of the actual fighting of conflicts and the ways in which, in the U.S. tradition, conflicts have had ramifications well beyond the scope or the seeming time period of a given war. World War I is a great example in terms of the curtailment of civil liberties and the kind of reaction in the 20s and 30s to the civil liberties that had been curtailed in the course of the conflict, that is the Espionage and Sedition Acts, and the ways in which those prevented sort of First Amendment rights from being exercised. However, the divide between scholars and the public at large is the one that I think really is being addressed by these questions we're talking about, and that is Americans tend to think of their own history as divided into this neat periodization of wartime and peacetime. And while scholars may have done significant work to add complexity to that and nuance, we're still struck by the sort of consistency of this paradigm between war and peace, even if, as Mary has shown, essentially, at least in the last half of the 20th century through the present, the U.S. has been more or less in a state of wartime throughout that period. Those are essential issues. I think also, in terms of isolationism and international engagement, you see here one of the ramifications of my reading Mary's superb book was thinking through the ways in which so-called peace times are moments to grapple with perhaps the undoing at home and abroad of American ideals. And here my reference before to William James fits in. Americans after the Spanish-American War of 1898 really did begin to grapple with the fact that perhaps having territories and being a colonial power was anathema to the nation's sort of revolutionary origins. That is, as James and the anti-imperialists continued to argue through the early 1900s, that ruling alien peoples against their will was something that no nation born in revolution should do. And so, too, I would say we see in Mary's book and in the unfolding 100-plus years, the ways in which Americans debated their role in the world after conflicts theoretically had ended. So even though American troops, they don't fully come out of Europe until 1923, and the armistice having been in November 1918, Americans in the 20s and 30s are vigorously debating whether or not the nation should employ its troops abroad. However, scholars would argue, note that the U.S. was deploying Marines throughout Central and South America and the Caribbean throughout that period. So the sort of waning and waxing of wartime and peacetime also dovetail with debates over an isolationist or internationalist perspective on committing diplomatic and military force abroad.
Now, I'd like to go back to this central question that I believe, Mary Drewjack, your book is ultimately addressing, which is when we are in a supposed wartime, a time of war, it erodes much of the public's vigilance and engagement, as well as their civil liberties, so that it's ultimately eroding democratic structures at the same time. What I'd like to do is to have you address this question here, and then I'm going to reverse this to Pat James to look at the effect of democracy on wartime. So first, wartime's effect on democracy.
One thing that's important in our current era is the way that everyday Americans have been encouraged not to be engaged with their nation's military deployment abroad. If you compare that with World War II, sometimes Americans have been encouraged to be engaged, right? World War II plants a victory garden, buy the war bond, which is a way that the Roosevelt administration tried to get the American people themselves to feel that this was a war that they personally were involved in. Now, fast forward to post 9/11, and of course, we were told not to sacrifice, not to participate, but to go shopping, go on vacation, or the terrorists have won. I think Obama is doing his own version of the same thing. Tie a yellow ribbon, send the troops a thank you note, but let's not be deeply politically engaged with what they're actually doing. And so the more the American people are isolated from the cost of war, which we are, with no draft, with more outsourcing, with more use of high-tech warfare, the American people are isolated from the sacrifice of war and encouraged not to be politically engaged. What that then leaves us with is no meaningful political check on the war powers. I think that we're at a moment in American politics when we have to ask whether there's a means of having a workable restraint on the president's ability to go it alone. And I think the only hope is if the American people are more deeply engaged, then they, through their Congress members, can, whether it's a war declaration or other kinds of congressional action, that's the way the people can have a role, right? In our system, it's generally through Congress. But also we saw in Vietnam the way the people unhappy with the course of the war in Vietnam had their say by getting out in the streets. And so one of the reasons you don't see any meaningful pushback from American war policy is that the people aren't engaged, and so we have no democratic accountability.
How does that fit, Pat James, with the democratic peace theory, democracy's effect on war?
Well, the democratic peace theory is about pairs of countries, so it doesn't contradict it in the sense that democracies are very happy to go out and beat up on countries that are regarded as being miserable and unpleasant to deal with. Certainly the United States and other leading democracies like Britain have had no hesitation in going to war. The Democratic peace thesis is about, of course, how much the democracies are very fond of each other. It's morphed into a whole gigantic industry of adding in other variables, as in, gee whiz, is it because they're rich, actually, or is it because they tend to be able to have enforceable contracts with each other? Reasonable people, and I'll cut very quickly to the chase about what the research is saying, would say that it's, as opposed to being atomic, it's molecular. It's not so much democracy as a cluster of interrelated traits that the leading countries like the U.S. and, let's say, Britain, for the sake of argument earlier, had. Namely, there's a system leader, the U.S. now, and they tend to be rich, and they tend to be capitalists, and they tend to be investors, and so on and so forth. So really, none of what Mary says would threaten the democratic peace. The much more interesting question, of course, is, all right, if that's intact, what about all this war that seems to be going on? And if I could take a few moments more, I quite agree with her on the disengagement. The symptoms are all over the place that the brilliant analysis offered by Mansur Olson in The Rise and Decline of Nations 30 years ago is right on target, in that take two rather odious traits of the United States right now. One is it's absolutely ridiculous and profligate overspending, and the other is that it's seemingly, you know, almost mindless involvement at times in overseas conflict with no apparent or obvious cost to the public that leads to protest. All of this makes perfectly good sense when you look back at what Olson said 30 years ago, that eventually interest groups of one stripe or another, if left unchecked, will take over and dominate a political system. So I would say that what we have ultimately right now is what Eisenhower warned us against when he left office in 1961, a very powerful military industrial complex that is eating money up like candy, alongside any number of other interest groups that have created huge, gargantuan even government programs that we can't afford. And the public kind of blithely goes along with it because only now, very, very late in the Obama administration, are the cracks in the edifice starting to come to the surface, as in who wants to lend the United States money anymore, who has enough to do so to afloat American debt. I think these phenomena of huge unchecked government activities are very much connected to each other.
Chris McNichols, we're going to give you the last word. I have one thought I'd like to interject here, and that is, you know, George Orwell in 1984 wrote about perpetual war, while Immanuel Kant wrote about perpetual peace. I guess we're not in number two.
Perhaps we are in a state of perpetual war. One thing that both comments just now remind me of is Alexis de Tocqueville in Democracy in America argued that one of the most terrifying things for all republics is what he called military glory. And he contrasted the American case with that of Europe, and he got a few of these things right and a few wrong. But what's most interesting, trying to modernize that sensibility and thinking about it in both the legal and international relations as well as historical context, is exactly this, your point, that in a state of perpetual war, one other variable seems particularly salient that we haven't talked a lot about yet, and that is technological change. And Mary mentioned drone strikes. But it seems to me that on questions, say, about the War Powers Resolution of 1973 and whether or not Americans are likely to protest in terms of any of our ongoing conflicts or perhaps future conflicts, the fact that these wars are being waged largely by technological means outside of the purview of Americans and with somewhat dubious international legality strikes me as perhaps the most salient new development here, a change from the sorts of questions that Americans asked after, say, the Second World War. Was the second dropping, if not the first, of an atomic weapon morally justified? For example, we don't seem to be having those sorts of deliberations about drone strikes, at least not significantly. And that would be something that would be good for democracy in the way that Mary lays out in her conclusion.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. So let me thank the three of you, Mary Jujak, professor of law, history, and political science at University of Southern California, and author of several books, including the one we're talking about, Wartime, An Idea, Its History, Its Consequences. Patrick James is the director of the Center for International Studies and a professor of international relations at USC. He's authored numerous books, including Religion, Identity, and Global Governance, Crisis in War, A New Quest for International Peace, and Wars in the Midst of Peace. Chris McKnight-Nichols, professor of History at University of Pennsylvania and author of a number of books, including Promise and Peril, America at the Dawn of a Global Age. Thank you all so very much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Maria. Take care.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests, and special thanks to Ankina Aghasyan, who produces the show with me. Also, special thanks to Ismail Karim, our assistant producer. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can always go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives. You can keep up with us on thescholarscircle.org or armoodian.com.